Good afternoon, folks, and welcome. It's time to break free. I will be your host for the hour, David Matthew Rock, coming to you live from the constitutional carry state of Arizona via the Patriot broadcast from the trenches, 89.5 FM, Chiloquin, the state of Jefferson. Simulcast on IndianaFreedomTalkRadio.com, the Grow Your Own channel, 107.5 FM, Greenville, South Carolina. Jalapeno's channel, 87.9 FM, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And many more micro-broadcasts and webcasts heard around the world. Take the time to check out the number one source for Patriot news on the web at FromTheTrenchesWorldReport.com. If you'd like to contact me via email, I can be reached at DavidMatthewRock@gmail.com. This is a live call-in program. Come on up and share your thoughts and experiences. Unlike the mainstream media, listener participation is appreciated. The call-in number is 641-715-3610. Once connected, you'll be asked for the conference room number, which is 220029, the pound sign. Hit star 6 to unmute. All right, folks, it is currently 1:02 p.m. Arizona Mountain Time. It is 98 degrees in Casa Grande, Arizona, sunny with 38% humidity. Today we're going to start out with a soundbite from an article on NPR titled, "Who Snatched My Car?" Wells Fargo did. We will get into it as soon as we return from these messages from our sponsors. You take a mortal man and put him in control. Watch him become a god.
The phrase, you are what you eat? Not true. Actually, you are what you can absorb. So if the vitamins and supplements you now take are not being absorbed, what good are they? Introducing Protovite, a proprietary liquid system that allows premium quality nutrients to positively affect the blood in an astonishing 5 minutes. Watch our amazing 2-minute live blood cell video at TrueNutritionNow.com. That's TrueNutritionNow.com. Then call 520-829-1133. Protovite is nutrition you can feel. Protovite is nutrition that gets in.
Hey, old Dr. Bones here. Are you prepared to deal with medical issues in a disaster situation? What would you do if medical help was not on the way? The Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook is over 400 pages of how-to advice written in plain English. You'll learn to handle all the likely medical issues you'll encounter in times of trouble. And it's not just the conventional medical wisdom. We talk about alternatives like essential oils, medicinal herbs, and other home remedies. Make the Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook a part of your survival library. And don't forget, Nurse Amy and I have medical kits, suture materials, instructional DVDs, and other items that'll help you keep it together even if things fall apart. Check them out, as well as 200 articles on medical preparedness, survival gardening, and other alternative remedies on our website at www.doomandbloom.net. Never think doom and gloom, think doom and bloom.
Divergent Flavor Labs introduces our all-original e-juice flavor line made from pure 100% kosher USP food-grade ingredients. Whether it's our flavored tobaccos like Calypso or our amazing bakery flavors like Creme de Liumptious, Divergent Flavor Labs handmade all-original flavor line will never disappoint. Available exclusively through VaporsRebellion.com.
Thank you for listening to PBFTT.
Patriot Broadcast from the Trenches, 89.5.
Micro FM.
Chiloquin, the state of Jefferson.
All right, folks. So doing my daily morning search, I came across this article on NPR titled, Who Snatched My Car? Wells Fargo did. And normally I would just read this type of thing, but considering they had somebody being interviewed in it, and the article is the exact same thing as the audio, I'm just going to go ahead and start out by playing this audio. So here we go.
Another scandal at Wells Fargo has been uncovered. This time, the bank signed up nearly 500,000 customers with auto loans for insurance that they didn't need. They didn't need it because they already had car insurance. Customers say they had no idea this was happening and that the bank expected them to pay for this extra policy.
Bullshit.
Wells Fargo acknowledges that tens of thousands of people wound up in default, which affected credit scores, and thousands had their cars repossessed. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Back in February, Michael Pfeiffer was heading off to his job in Maryland at a company that builds guitars, and he walked to the spot where he'd parked his car the night before, but it wasn't there.
I called the police. I was livid. I thought somebody stole my car.
Somebody had improperly made off with Pfeiffer's car, but it wasn't car thieves. It was Wells Fargo Bank, which the police told Pfeiffer.
And that's when I found out it was repossessed.
Which he says didn't seem to make any sense.
I was confused because my payments are automatically taken out. I've never missed a payment. My insurance is current.
So he called Wells Fargo, which we should note is a sponsor of NPR, and he says he was told that the bank had put another insurance policy on his car. And that got him marked as delinquent for not paying that insurance, which he didn't want or need or even know about.
They said, well, you owe $1,500.
So Pfeiffer got all his documents together, and he made an appointment at his local Wells Fargo bank branch.
I showed up at that bank with my bank statement showing all the payments I made for my vehicle and my proof of insurance showing that I've never had a lapse in my insurance.
And so they were just scratching their heads basically like, huh, why did we repossess this car?
Exactly. The people at the bank were like, well, you shouldn't know anything because it's not your fault. They were just as confused as I was.
Pfeiffer says the employees at the branch were trying to be helpful. They called up the Wells Fargo department for him that deals with car repossessions to try to find out what was going on. They put on the speakerphone, but that didn't work out so well because all of them kept getting put on hold.
We were probably on hold for a total of 2.5 hours while I was in there.
Wow.
I literally spent the whole day at the Wells Fargo branch that I was at. The employees at the Wells Fargo there were getting frustrated, too. They're like, this is ridiculous. You shouldn't be on hold for this long.
What Pfeiffer didn't know is that Wells Fargo had already been doing an internal investigation into complaints from lots and lots of customers for this same problem. But that didn't seem to help Pfeiffer that day. He was eventually told to call back later in the week. When he did, the woman on the phone said there was no record of his prior calls from the branch.
Bullshit.
And she was rude to me. She was talking over me. I felt like she wasn't willing to hear what I had to say. The only thing she wanted to hear was, I'm going to pay this money right now.
Meanwhile, Pfeiffer was told that his car was going to be auctioned off 2 weeks from the day it was repossessed. So in the end, after much haggling with the bank, he paid about $600 to get his car back. Pfeiffer figured this was just some freak thing, but when he heard that this insurance debacle affected 500,000 customers...
I was blown away. I wasn't alone in it, and I felt like they're preying on everybody, taking people's money. I felt like they're crooks.
Wells Fargo says that this was not a case of trying to improperly profit at customers' expense,
bullshit,
but rather just an embarrassing breakdown in processes and internal controls.
Bullshit.
In a statement, the bank acknowledges that 490,000 customers were signed up for insurance that they did not need. The bank is setting aside $80 million to reimburse customers. Class action lawsuits are being filed. The bank has no comment on those. But a spokesperson says Wells Fargo is very sorry for Michael Pfeiffer's experience and that he will be included in the remediation effort. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Well, there's that, folks. So apparently, even if you don't need insurance because you already have full coverage, Wells Fargo just felt it needed to put insurance on your ride anyway, and now is repossessing your vehicles because of not paying their insurance. So I just heard a ding on the caller line. You want to confirm that you can hear me okay and that we're set up real good? Well, all right. So what I did here is I went to FromTheTrenchesWorldReport.com, and I just put in Wells Fargo right into the search engine. So I was just kind of curious because I remember hearing lots of different articles coming out about Wells Fargo. So let's just take a look down this list real fast. So Lowe's, Wells Fargo outsourcing Americans' jobs to cheap foreign workers. That was posted June 26, 2017 by Shalom. Panic as Wells Fargo makes dramatic move, prepares for massive crash. That was May 17, 2017 by Gray Rider. Undocumented students sue Wells Fargo for denying her student loan. Well, that doesn't exactly apply. Wells Fargo may have to close 1,000 branches after fake account scandal. Remember that? That was October 22nd, 2016, posted by Mark W. Wells Fargo CEO forfeits $40 million to keep the fight to keep job, or in fight to keep job. So posted September 28th by Admin 2016. Former employee files class action lawsuit against Wells Fargo. So, and that was in directly relating to the one that we read before about the fraudulent accounts that they created. So that was by Admin September 24, 2016. Wells Fargo probed by feds over sales tactics, posted by Admin September 15, 2016. So it just goes right on down the list. Like, Wells Fargo has been in a bunch of messes. There's even one right here, Wells Fargo to Hogue. Now Hogue makes like grips for pistols. We won't do business with weapons manufacturers. That was posted August 2nd, 2016, so like a year ago, by Mark W. So there's Wells Fargo for you. So you might want to, if you have a loan through Wells Fargo, you might want to go check with them and make sure that they are not doing this to you before they go ahead and repossess your vehicle. Because it seems that they're going to put you in a position where you're going to have to pay them money, otherwise they're going to auction off your car within just 2 weeks. So next we're going to move on to an article posted at FromTheTrenchesWorldReport.com by me for discussion. It's called Why America's Wages Are Barely Rising. So from my understanding, when we're going through a depression, or when we went through the Great Depression, if you were to go read news articles from that time period, you would find stories where simultaneously they're telling you the economy is doing good and the economy is doing bad, or that employment is up and employment is down. And that creates so much confusion that nobody ever really gets a good idea of what's going on at that particular moment, and it helps to, I'm guessing, settle everybody down so they don't get angry and start turning towards who's to blame with pitchforks and torches in hand. So we're going to go ahead and start reading this. Why America's Wages Are Barely Rising. Posted August 3rd, 2017 by John Yidstai. I don't even know how to pronounce that. Americans have been waiting for a solid pay raise for years. Maybe there's good news awaiting them as the country employs more people. The U.S. economic recovery has gone on for 8 long years. Are they kidding me? The U.S. economic recovery has gone on for 8 long years? It surely doesn't feel like that.
Bullshit.
And the unemployment rate is at a low 4.4%, but wage gains have barely budged. That's got economists scratching their heads. Oh, you mean those bullshit people that are paid to lie in the media? Is that what you're talking about, economists? All right. Andrew Chamberlain, the chief economist at the jobs and recruiting company, Glassdoor, says even as the unemployment rate fell to a 16-year low, wage growth has slowed. The company's own data for July confirmed that. He says it shows very sluggish growth, the slowest pace we've recorded in 3 years, and it's the 6th straight month that pay growth has declined. So isn't the stock market doing pretty good right now? So what exactly is going on here? What's causing this wage stagnation? I'd be willing to bet it's the fact that they've put us in a position where we feel obligated to work for these lower wages because we're thinking that we're not going to get a job otherwise. So I imagine psychology has a lot to do with this. If people were not willing to work for a certain wage, they really couldn't find workers. But then again, you could also say that illegals have a lot to do with this as well, because if we're not willing to work for a certain wage, they can just turn around and hire these illegals. Okay, so the Labor Department's numbers aren't quite that bad, but they do show wage growth averaging at 2.5% in the past 4 months after peaking at 2.9% in December. Well, that would be a significant amount if it was growing that much per month, so that doesn't even make sense. I'm not sure what they get a percentage based off of. The latest figures will be part of Friday's unemployment report for July. Chamberlain says wage growth at this stage of an economic recovery should be close to 3 to 5%. Monthly? Is that what they're saying? Because I've never seen that anywhere I've worked at. I've never seen 3 to 5% a month anywhere. You'd be lucky if you got a quarter in a given fiscal year. U.S. hourly earnings growth slows since the Great Recession. Year over year, change in hourly wages, seasonally adjusted. So they got a graph here, and they're showing a wage peak at 2009, and then they're showing the lowest of the wage increases, I guess, at 2010. And then you get a very jittery line that rises up to a high at 2017, and now that we're halfway through the fiscal year, it's dropped down a little bit. So that's what we're looking at the graph, or that's what we're seeing on this graph, and it's coming from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So apparently we're at our peak in 2009, we got to our low point in 2010, and we've got about halfway up that ladder in around December of 2017, and now we're on a slight decline. Probably all full of shit. I wouldn't believe any of the stuff coming out of the establishment.
Bullshit.
Okay. He says there are a number of theories about why this hasn't happened. One is that many young, inexperienced workers are entering the labor force. What's new about that? Wouldn't that be happening every generation? Wouldn't that be omnipresent? Hasn't that always been the case? Aren't there always newer, young, inexperienced workers coming into the labor force? So that sounds like bullshit to me.
Bullshit.
All right, so where are we at? he says they are replacing the baby boomers who are leaving during their peak earning years. Well, that may be true, but isn't that always the case? Wouldn't you constantly be cycling people out and bringing people in? And if the population is being reduced like they say it is, if we're underbreeding in the first world, then we should have less people replacing the people that we had working for us previously. Those young workers are paid much less and are dragging down the earnings growth for the nation as a whole. Chamberlain says there's another factor in the disconnect. The low unemployment rate does not reflect the fact that a large number of prime age workers remain outside the labor force, so they are not counted as unemployed. These are people between ages 25 and 54, the prime working ages, who are not looking for a job, but might if the conditions were right, he says. So that's pretty vague. So I imagine there's people that are not looking for a job because the rate of pay is shit. Like me personally, I won't work for under $25 an hour. There's just no way that I'll do it. I can go on Craigslist right now and throw up some ads, and I can get some work, and I can get that rate of pay. So there's no point in me going to work for somebody else for anything less. And in my opinion, anything less than that, and you're not going to be saving enough money to the point where you're really going to be getting anywhere anyways. If you're making anything less than $25 an hour, you're just basically working to pay your bills and nothing more. And as soon as a big bill comes in, you're squashed. You're done. As soon as a big something goes wrong with your car, or you got some sort of dental work that needs to be done, any little bit of money that you saved up is going to be gone, like a flash in the pan. Okay, sometimes these are stay-at-home parents, he says. Sometimes they are people with an injury that has kept them out of the labor force. But at the right price, the right offer, it would pull them back in. About 22% of this prime age group remain on the sidelines of the labor force. That number was lower before the Great Recession, Chamberlain says, and a good-paying job is the best way to lure them back. Well, duh. if you want to get people in the workforce, you offer them a decent pay. Yeah, that'll definitely lure people back. People who are out of the labor force face a trade-off. Chamberlain says they ask themselves, is it worth it? When I factor in all the taxes and benefits and the cost of daycare, is it worth it to me to take a full-time job or not? He says rapid wage growth can tip the balance. Well, then it seems all these CEOs and these billionaire bastards out there need to just share. Do you really need to have that much money coming into your accounts on an annual basis? Or can you just pay your employees a fair wage? Or maybe offer your goods and services at a lower price? So it seems to me the only reason these people end up getting so wealthy in the first place is they're using the power of government to knock out all their competitions, all their competitors. Okay, economist Dean Baker of the Center of Policy Research agrees. He often sees reports of employees complaining that they can't find enough workers. And he says, I look at it, you know, and I say, have you tried raising wages? Chamberlain says this prime age group has been slowly returning to the workforce as wages have slowly risen. But he says, now, okay, so the Federal Reserve admits 2% inflation as a targeted goal annually. So if your wages are not raising higher than the inflation rate, then even though you're seeing more digits in your account, those don't go as far, so you're really not making anything. So, I mean, if their targeted inflation rate is 2%, in a decade, that's 20%. So a dollar, you're now going to need $1.20 to buy the same amount of goods and services, and that's going with their bullshit numbers. And their bullshit numbers, when it comes to their targeted inflation rate, does not include food and energy, right? So, I mean, obviously, they're feeding us a line of shit, and they're just... What the inflation is doing is they're slowly taxing everybody, and they're slowly destroying everybody's wages, and they're slowly destroying everybody's savings. So unless we put a stop to this inflation, minimum wage increases and just wage increases in general are just you're feeding the symptom. What's the term I'm looking for? You're not addressing the cause. And the cause of all this, if you really want to get down to it, is the Federal Reserve System. Obviously, there's a lot of stuff going on in the federal government where they're making it impossible to do business. There's so much regulations and all that. But at the heart of the matter is the Federal Reserve System. When you look at the inflation from when the Federal Reserve took over until today, it'll blow your mind. And the best way to understand inflation is you need to see what a gallon of milk cost. You need to see what a loaf of bread cost. You need to see what a tailored suit cost between then and today. And then you got to pair that or compare that with the price of gold and the price of silver. And then you'll get a better idea of what the inflation means. You'll get a better idea of when somebody tells you, oh, in 1950 something, I was getting paid 75 cents an hour. Well, if you look at what 75 cents would buy you back then, that 75 cents was actually a decent wage. It might be even more. Once you factor inflation, it might be even more than what you're making today. So there's this constant game going on with the inflation. You have to be very wary in understanding that. So when they're showing you a graph like this and they're saying that the inflation rate is only going 2%, or excuse me, the wages is only going up 2%, then that's just matching the inflation rate, which means absolutely nothing. So let's see if I can find where I left off here. Baker says there's a danger that Federal Reserve interest rate hikes could slow the economy before enough of these workers return. For the moment, he says, it looks like they, the Fed, are going to put off further rate hikes. That's good, he says, because it will allow more growth that can attract more of these people back to work. So why do we have a council of private bankers holding our whole economy in their hands? That and let's say, I'm sure some of what they're talking about here with them raising the rates and all that it doesn't exactly work out the way they're saying it to, and it's probably some sort of propaganda. But why are they trying to get us to believe that a council of bankers have all of our economy in control, have our best interests in mind, and are sitting there like mad scientists tuning everything to match what the economy is doing to keep us from having another great recession or another great depression? Now, to me, it would seem that why would I want one centralized banking system? If somebody just hacks their computers and crashes their system, then we're all shit out of luck, aren't we? Wouldn't you want many competing systems, all simultaneously working with each other, working against each other? That way you get a more sound dollar, you get more stability, and if one company starts doing things that you don't like, you get to pull your wealth, your savings out of that company and go start dealing with somebody else. And now let's go into this a little deeper. What are we talking about when we say dollar? We're not talking about gold. We're not talking about silver. And in this day and age, we're not even talking about copper. The penny's not even made out of copper. It's made out of zinc. So what we're really talking about is a paper IOU, a coin that's made from zinc with a little bit of a silver or copper wash on the exterior to give it the facade of looking like a legitimate coin. And then we're talking nothing but digits on a hard drive. So that's what money is, okay? It is an IOU. And the way that it kind of works out is you're going to give me some of your time, which is your life's most precious possession, because you can't get it back. Now, let's say I build houses for a living and you come work for me. Now, you already have a house. I can't pay you over the course of time in houses. I can't pay you in building materials. I can't pay you in nails, because it would be too much of a pain in the ass for you to try to put that stuff back into the market to gather up the things that you need. So what we do is we make an agreement. You're going to give me some of your time, and I'm going to give you an IOU. Okay, because what I produce with my business is not what you need to be able to live. I'm going to give you this IOU. And the reason that you're willing to take it is because you have faith that the economy will accept it. So a dollar in and of itself is nothing more than a faith-based economy-wide IOU note. Okay, and we trade these dollars for either goods or services, which are time and material. Okay. Now, some people may disagree, and that's absolutely fine on this point that I'm going to make right now. And I would welcome them to come up and we'll talk about it. We'll debate it. I firmly believe that gold and silver are wealth. Okay. They are highly liquid. They are as good as money, but I believe that they are, because they have a physical presence, because you can touch them, because they were pulled out of the earth, and because of their intrinsic value, they are what you would consider wealth. And I put them in the same category as your car or your house or your rifles or anything else that's physical in nature and highly liquid. I believe owning gold and silver is a good thing. I believe gold and silver can be used, as well as copper and other precious metals or semi-precious, can be used as a currency system. And history has shown that no matter what has gone on with religions and governments, gold, silver, copper, they have always been traded as such. So, but at the same time, how much gold and copper do all of you guys have? And not only on that, in addition to that, if you are an employee, how much gold, silver, and copper does your employer have? Now, could they pay you in gold, silver, and copper? If all of a sudden tomorrow we just decided to switch off to a gold and silver system, could they pay you tomorrow in gold and silver? I beg to differ that they couldn't. So I kind of got down a rabbit hole a little bit with this article, but I'd like to discuss it a little more, and I'd like to open it up to the callers to come in and discuss how they feel about money, and we can continue on this subject after the break.
I'm taking fighter.
You've heard the phrase, you are what you eat. Not true. Actually, you are what you can absorb. So if the vitamins and supplements you now take are not being absorbed, what good are they? Introducing Protovite, a proprietary liquid system that allows premium quality nutrients to positively affect the blood in an astonishing 5 minutes. Watch our amazing 2-minute live blood cell video at TrueNutritionNow.com. That's TrueNutritionNow.com. Then call 520-829-1133. Protovite is nutrition you can feel. Protovite is nutrition that gets in.
Hey, old Dr. Bones here. Are you prepared to deal with medical issues in a disastrous situation? What would you do if medical help was not on the way? The Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook is over 400 pages of how-to advice written in plain English. You'll learn to handle all the likely medical issues you'll encounter in times of trouble. And it's not just the conventional medical wisdom. We talk about alternatives like essential oils, medicinal herbs, and other home remedies. Make the Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook a part of your survival library. And don't forget, Nurse Amy and I have medical kits, suture materials, instructional DVDs, and other items that'll help you keep it together even if things fall apart. Check them out, as well as 200 articles on medical preparedness, survival gardening, and other alternative remedies on our website at www.doomandbloom.net. Never think doom and gloom, think doom and bloom.
Divergent Flavor Labs introduces our all-original e-juice flavor line made from pure 100% kosher USP food-grade ingredients. Whether it's our flavored tobaccos like Calypso or our amazing bakery flavors like Creme de Liumptious, Divergent Flavor Labs' handmade all-original flavor line will never disappoint. Available exclusively through VaporRebellion.com.
Thank you for listening to PBFTT.
Patriot Broadcast from the Trenches, 89.5.
Micro FM.
Chiloquin, the state of Jefferson.
It's Time to Break Free is a listener-sponsored broadcast. If you'd like to help keep this program on the air, go to FromTheTrenchesWorldReport.com and hit that donate button. Or you can mail donations to Henry Shively at Post Office Box 964, Chiloquin, Oregon 97624. Your contributions are appreciated. All right, it is 1:38 p.m. Arizona Mountain Time. And that was the Ramones with We Want the Airwaves coming out of the break. So I want to get back into this money discussion. I went down the rabbit hole reading the NPR article, but you know what? It was probably bullshit to begin with and probably not worth reading.
Bullshit.
So as I'm talking here, if there's any callers that would like to unmute and come on up, I wanted to get into what money is and maybe how we can implement it as a solution and maybe how we should think about money in general. So I'll just go right to the nuts and bolts of it. This is my thoughts on the subject. This is what I'm thinking. And the gentleman who did the documentary Riddles in Stone, I can't recall his name right out of the gates, but he's the one that kind of put this in my mind. And on its face, I agree with it. The bankers got rich from gold and silver. And they used paper money based off of that gold and silver to do it. But from my understanding, it works as simple as this. When you go down to the older mercantile systems, the older banking systems, if they made a loan with interest, now say if they made a loan in physical gold and actually delivered the gold, but then required interest, okay, that means that they're going to get more money back than they actually put in. Now, over time, as they make more and more loans and build up a better reputation and they loan to more individuals, eventually they're going to start getting the majority of the gold and silver under their control because of the interest rates. So what they can do over time is allow less and less of this gold back out on the market. So they make fewer and fewer loans, which tightens the supply of gold. We'll just use gold as an example. It could be silver, it could be seashells, it doesn't really matter. They tighten the supply. Now, over time, this makes gold more valuable, which means each little ounce of gold per se is going to buy you more than what it previously did. So there's less gold on the market. The bank is holding on to more gold. The prices of everything are starting to change to where this gold becomes more valuable. So now what these banking institutions do is they take their mountain of gold that they've collected and they buy up key infrastructure. So I assume, first off, that would probably be their competition. They'd probably want to buy up any other competing banks. But they're also going to want to profit every step of the game. So they're going to buy up the merchant companies. They're going to buy up production companies. They're going to buy the docks. They're going to buy newspapers. They're going to buy all this key infrastructure, which gives them more control. So then they can repeat the whole process, right? So once they buy up their key infrastructure, they can make loans easy again, and they can put more money out on the market. And then this changes the value of everything and makes the coin not go as far, okay? And then through these booms and bust cycles, they can eventually buy up the entire economy. And from my understanding of history is they were able to do that on gold and silver. But they also realized that they could keep the gold in-house and that people would prefer to have a receipt for the gold and silver because it was safer to travel with. People had faith that the bank would honor that receipt. Therefore, it became safer and easier to travel with the notes. And the banks realized that they could loan out 10 times as much paper than they actually have gold because it was rare that people actually came to collect. But what I'm thinking is going on with this fiat dollar is at the same time the bankers have used it against us. It has empowered the bankers to do this fractional reserve system. But at the same time, it allows us or any other governing body or any other group or institution to completely cut them out of the loop. Let's say, for instance, they do have the majority of gold, in their different world banking institutions around the globe, that they have the majority. Let's just make that assumption. If we were to come out with our own paper dollar or our own digital currency or our own coins. I don't care what kind of metal you're making them on them, as long as people have faith in them or are honoring them. If any of these systems come out by any of their competitors, what can they do to stop us? You know, they're going to have to actually do warfare, or, you know, the surreptitious shit that we see right now where they're coming at us through the media. So I'm of the belief that we can use a fiat dollar to completely cut the central bankers out of the loop. But before that can happen, we need to have a good understanding of what that is. And I discussed that before. It is an IOU. It is temporary. It is transitory. It is not meant to be a permanent place to store your time and material, okay? So basically, if you get paid in these IOU notes, you should want to turn them into something of value fast. You're not going to want to hang on to them. You're not going to want to shove them under the mattress, because they are a liability. They are not an asset. Until you spend them into the marketplace, they can lose their value. They could gain value. They could go up in smoke, quite literally, sitting under your mattress. Somebody could steal them, or something could happen in the economy where people decide not to take them anymore or won't honor them. And we've seen that in economies around the world. One being would be India, where they blocked the, believe it was the 500,000 rupee note from circulating. So one needs to understand that these dollars, these coins printed out of zinc, these digital benchmarks on a hard drive, which represent our checking and savings accounts, are all liabilities. Until you spend out of them, you are subject to their value, and you're subject to what people's belief of their value is and what people are willing to take and trade for them. So it is a smart thing to buy gold and silver. It would definitely be a smarter thing to have clothing, boots, food, water, gas masks, rifles, ammunition, all of these things. And okay, let's take a different look at this. We have the U.S. Treasury Department, and directly underneath them we have the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Okay, and one of the first things our government did after it got going under President Washington was to put down the Whiskey Rebellion in Pennsylvania. So when the Treasury Department has a policing bureau called the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, that should ring some bells for you, okay? So what we're talking about there is highly liquid material assets. Assets that are so highly liquid that they are as good as money. Tobacco and alcohol and firearms are as good as money. So, yeah, any callers want to come up anytime, just feel free to interrupt me. I'd actually love to have a debate on this. If you don't agree that a fiat dollar can actually be used as a solution, I would love for you to come up and let's get a little deeper into it and let's hear your point of view. So, yes, so one of the things our federal government could do right now, I have no love for the federal government. I don't trust the federal government one bit. I'm going to stand against them every step of the way, and I'm going to speak out against them every step of the way. But if they had our best interest in mind, one thing they could do right now is start issuing money not birthed out of debt, okay? Because the way it stands right now, the way they're partnering up with this Federal Reserve System, all money is created because somebody either borrowed it or the federal government borrowed it. So that means all of this money was created with interest, which also means if we were to pay back all of the debt, it would cancel out the money supply. There is not enough money in supply to cancel out the debt. And that's assuming that all money is birthed out of debt, which from all of my research has shown me that. So that means that if you were to want to keep this current monetary system functioning, and I don't mean necessarily under the same control, but you want to keep this economy functioning, one of the first things the federal government could do is start issuing money not birthed out of debt. And instead of finding new fantastic ways to make this happen, we have all these other liabilities that we already have in place: Social Security, Medicare, different welfare programs, all of these programs. Obviously, there's too many of them. There's redundancies. The government shouldn't be involved in welfare. I don't agree with big government at all. But for a process, something that would happen over a period of time, one of the first things they could do is start issuing all of these checks with newly created money not birthed out of debt, okay? And the whole point is because as this money goes back to a bank, it no longer circulates. It cancels out the debt that created the money in the first place. So if all the loans are paid back, it would extinguish the money supply. To avoid that from happening, we can issue this newly created money. Now, simultaneous to that, we could stop taking the income, Medicare, and Social Security taxes out of everybody's checks. So everybody is going to get an automatic bonus right back in their pocket. Okay? Now, because we're going to stop taking these IRS-related taxes, instead of putting all these IRS people out of work, which they probably should be put out of work, and they probably need to get tried for treason and all that, but I guarantee if you propose a system that puts them all out of work, they're going to be completely opposed to it. So one thing that we can give them an option to do is to start looking into all these banks. So we just brought up this hour the fraud coming out of Wells Fargo. Okay, and I went through the search in the on FromTheTrenchesWorldReport.com and showed you many articles where they were fraudulent. Okay, we also got we've also seen the news about Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, also known as HSBC, laundering drug money. So they've shifted all the papers around. They've created these mortgage bundled assets, and it's hard to tell who owns what this day and age. So one thing we could do is take these IRS agents and sick them on the banks. So why we're implementing this program of issuing new money, why we're not taking money out of your checks again, we can take these IRS workers and have them do accounting work on these banks to slowly figure out who's who in the zoo, what went where the actual paper is on everybody's homes, so on and so forth. So it wouldn't necessarily crash the system, and you could put more money in everybody's pockets, and you could get new currency not issued out of debt into the marketplace, which would give us the ability to pay back our loans, you know, a car loan, house loan, housing loan, student loans, all of these different things. And that would keep the system functioning. So now I got a whole bunch of solutions that kind of go in line with that. But the idea of this is this was in the context of if the federal government had our best interests in mind, these are the things that could have been done a long time ago. They should have started doing stuff like this during the banker bailouts. It would immediately put money back in all of our pockets, which would get the economy to increase. It would get wages to go up, and it would all happen without anybody really noticing it. So as a solution, because the people in charge are never going to stop, they're going to take this all the way to the end. They've been working generationally to put this New World Order system together. They're not going to go down without a fight. So we can talk about these types of solutions, but they're never going to implement them. But if we put them to paper and maybe organize our thoughts better about them, we can show how defunct and how bullshit a governing body they are. So maybe it's something that we could use to wake up the sheep in the future. I can't really say. Another thing that we could also do as far as solutions and putting it to paper, you know what I mean, is the border security. This is something I was thinking about talking to Mark with at some point. If we can put a border security plan down on paper that shows all the elements, how quickly, the whole timeline, where to get the stuff, how many agents we have working above the border that can be sent down there, how to stagger them along the border, what type of equipment they use, so on and so forth. We could also use that to wake people up because the feds aren't going to do it. They have, it's been a policy not to secure the border for over 30 years. They're not going to do it without a fight. But one thing we can do is formulate a document that shows this is how the border security can be done, this is how much it would cost, and this is how quickly it can be put in. And that can be used to make the government look bad, to make people see what their true colors actually are. And when it starts to unravel that border security is bullshit, that the economy is bullshit, then maybe these same sheep will start to wake up and understand that maybe the war on terrorism is bullshit, and the war on drugs is bullshit, and for them to have an open border and for them to bring in the refugees and for them to leave the illegal rapists, they just throw them over the border without persecuting. Maybe this has more to do with growing a police state and dominating the American people than it has to do with security or safety. So anybody else want to chime in real quick? All right, so I'm going to call bullshit on the rest of that article about the economy.
Bullshit.
And this is something else that I thought was pretty interesting. And this is also coming from NPR. I sent it to FromTheTrenchesWorldReport.com for discussion. It was posted today, August 3rd, 2017, by Jake Harper. So it's titled, "To Grow Market Share, a Drug Maker Pitches Its Product to Judges." So that's interesting. When they say pitches its product to judges, the drug companies will give doctors vacations. They will buy them all sorts of free stuff, and they will send money directly their way the more people they prescribe on medications. So I'm thinking what this article might not be including and what it's actually getting at is drug companies are now lobbying judges to get judges to mandate the use of their drugs. So, Philip Kirby says he first used heroin during a stint in a halfway house a few years ago. Now, that's interesting. So, he got put in the system somehow, and that's where he got exposed to the heroin. When he was 21 years old, he quickly formed a habit. "You really can't dabble in it," he says. Late last year, Kirby was driving with drugs and a syringe in his car when he got pulled over. He went to jail for a few months on a separate charge before entering a drug program in Hamilton County, Indiana, north of Indianapolis. But before Kirby started, he says the court pressured him to get a shot of a drug called Vivitrol. Vivitrol is a monthly injection of naltrexone. Naltrexone, I can't pronounce that. I'll try. But which blocks opioid receptors in the brain. Okay, blocks opioid receptors in the brain. So that means dopamine receptors, okay? So that means the same receptors in your brain, like when you pick up a little fuzzy kit and you put it to your cheek and you get that little warm fuzzy feeling, that's your dopamine moving through your body. So this will basically give you a chemical lobotomy. And I would compare it to Chantrix, the drug that people use for quitting smoking. Same kind of stuff. It's one of three medications approved by the Food and Drug Administration for treating opioid addiction. While it's effective in some people, it's not for everyone. Patients have been ready to be opioid free, and some patients won't do well on it. It also can have side effects, which Kirby says he experienced. "I had sinus problems, chest problems for the whole month I was on it," Kirby says. "I couldn't shake it." He also says he got a rash, another possible reaction to Vivitrol, according to product's warnings. Months after he had the shot, he still had white splotches on his arms, while he attributed to the drug. But even with those symptoms, Kirby says the court urged him to stick with the medication for a couple of more months. "They were way too pushy about it," he says. More than 130,000 Americans will go through drug courts this year, according to the National Association of Drug Court Professionals. Now, I want to know what a drug court is and why we need a court specifically called a drug court. There should only be one type of court, in my opinion, as far as what an American national can be charged or tried through. Drug courts are designed to allow some people whose crimes stem from addiction to get treatment instead of jail time. Well, why should anybody be getting jail time for use of a narcotic? If anything, they should be getting sympathy. And when you put people in jail, you'll take somebody who is just a narcotics user, put them in jail, and they'll come out a full-blown criminal when they're done. And part of that is just to survive. If they're going to survive in that environment, they're going to have to toughen up, and they're going to have to do what the other inmates do, and they're going to start learning about crime. And they're going to come out of the system, and it's going to be very difficult for them to get a job. And now that they already have a better understanding of crime, you know, put two and two together, people. Okay. Boy, jail time. But the treatment that is offered varies from court to court and is entirely at the judge's discretion. Some courts offer participants a full range of evidence-based treatment, including medication-assisted treatment. Others do not allow addiction medications at all, and some permit just one, Vivitrol. Prime targets for marketing. One of the reasons for this preference is that Alkermes, the drug manufacturer, is doing something nearly unheard of in the pharmaceutical community. It's marketing directly to drug court judges and other officials. Which, you know, marketing, you might as well say lobbying, or you might as well say bribing. Because that's what's going on. You think these judges and these other officials are going to do anything that requires them extra work? Or do you really think they give a shit about people? I would say no. I would say if they're doing anything, they're doing it for money. And it's just the same thing as with a doctor. They're getting little perks. The strategy capitalizes on a market primed to prefer their products. Judges, prosecutors, and other criminal justice officials can be suspicious of the other FDA-approved addiction medications. I'm not sure I can pronounce that. Buprenorphine and methadone, because they are themselves opiates. Alkermes promotes its product as non-addictive. Of course, it kills the dopamine receptors in your brain. If that's what it's saying, that it clogs them up, that's what it's doing. It's killing them. And from my understanding, it's a double-edged sword. Once your receptors get plugged, you start creating more receptors. And then when the receptors become unplugged, you become more susceptible to things like depression. I know certain types of anabolic steroids function the same way. They block cortisol receptors. You grow more cortisol receptors, and then when your cortisol receptors become unblocked, you have more atrophy where your body is consuming itself faster. So these types of medications, when you're screwing with hormones in the brain, can be devastating. I guarantee all of you know somebody who's taken some form of newfangled birth control that has caused them to have hair and also and other types of problems, hormonal problems that have been permanent. And on that, where you didn't get a chance to finish the rest of our article today, but I appreciate you guys listening. And tomorrow is Oy Vey Friday, so we'll be back for that. Enjoy your day, ladies and gentlemen.